Jack, we've been friends for many, many years. Thank you very much for being our first person to be interviewed for the Rossay Living Museum. Perhaps you'll tell me a wee bit about the Wagstaff family and your Rossay heritage.
Well, of course, we were in St. John before we came here. We moved to St. John in 1953, and I was teaching at St. John High School.
53. Right.
And then I was hired as a chemistry teacher.
At the high school?
At St. John High.
Yep.
And we stayed there until 58, when I took a position in Sault Ste. Marie. And we were there for 2 years, when Dr. McKenzie phoned. He, of course, was a superintendent of schools of St. John City. He phoned and asked me to come back and offered me a position of the head of the chemistry department, and there had been no heads of departments up until that time. So we returned, but when we did come back here, we rented a house in Renforth. We stayed there for 2 years. And
this was when did you rent the first house?
1960.
Right.
And that was the house next to the Nesbitt House, right across from Fitzgerald's store. We stayed there 2 years. Now, when I came back in 1960, I preceded Sally Ann. I came down for a weekend, Easter weekend, in the spring, and started looking for a house, knowing that I was going to come back here. I met Bernie Elliott in town, and Bernie took me out to Milledgeville and was trying to sell me a house that he had just completed out there, and it wasn't one that I particularly liked the design of. So.
Right.
Anyway, I said, no, Bernie. So then he brought me out here, and we came out a dirt road, as I recall, and came down the Fox Farm Road, which was a dirt road at that time. 1960.
Fox Farm was a dirt road.
Was a dirt road. And then we came down on the Rossay Road, and then came up this area, and these were dirt roads up here. There was the Green Road, which only went a short distance beyond our house. There was the Renshaw, which came up to the first turn.
Right.
And then it was just a path up to the Renshaw house at that time. But where our house sits right now was a small field, and the local youngsters who were here using it as a playground.
Who owned the land here then?
That was owned by Bert Cosman.
Yes.
The Kinghurst Manor.
Yep.
A company which he formed.
Bert's a friend, yes.
Yeah. Anyway, Sally Ann arrived in September.
When had you and Sally Ann been married?
We were married early 1953.
53?
Yeah. So, anyway, she arrived in September to move into her house in Renforth, and I brought her up and showed her this lot, and she fell in love with it right away. Yeah. So we bought the lot, but we couldn't build for 2 years. Teacher's pay wasn't that high at the time. So anyway, we decided to build in 62.
What would a lot have been worth in those days?
Well, as I recall, I think we paid $2,800 with the water supply to the lot line, pressurized water. And we built the house. We started it in May the 6th, and it was completed late that fall.
Built it for you?
A chap by the name of, he's from Hatfield's Point. Was his name, Lee Boyd,
right.
and his crew. They took a few weeks off from work, which I didn't expect at all, but I didn't know just how people in Hatfield's Point, they had to take time off to do their haying. I'd forgotten about that. And then, of course, they had to take 2 weeks off to do hunting. So the whole thing was delayed somewhat. But we moved in Halloween Eve in 1962. At that time, there were very few houses up here. Three houses away was the furthest house, and that was, Sally Ann, what's his name? He just died last year.
No,
beyond Burt's. House beyond Burt's.
Ellis.
Yeah. Beyond Ellis is one more. Ward Haynes. Ward Haynes was the furthest house at that time. And Ward had built probably somewhere around 56 or 57, I'm making a guess. And then came Mrs. Ellis' house. and then Bert Cosman's. And they were both constructed by 1960.
John Britton's, Nancy Britton's, she was an Ellis, eh?
Yes, Nancy was an Ellis, a sister to Bert Cosman's wife, to Shirley.
Yep.
And Marvin Ellis was a brother. So half the population were Ellis's, or Ellis's connected.
How many families would have lived around here then?
Well, there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There were about 7 up in, right up in this area at that time.
Where was it, were you originally born?
I was born in Massachusetts, United States.
What brought you to Canada?
My parents. No, my father had been Nova Scotian born, brought up in a way, although he worked out in British Columbia and everything. He was a shipbuilder of 3 and 4 master schooners primarily. And that industry died in 1920. The last 3 master schooner was built along the shore where he was building was 1920. This is near Parisburg, Nova Scotia.
Right.
So he went to the United States and he took some of the workers that worked in the shipyard.
From Nova Scotia?
And he more or less formed a company up there and started building houses. And between 1922 and 1929, when the Depression hit, he built between 50 and 60 houses up there, he and his crew. Well, in 29, when the Depression hit, buildings came to a halt. So 3 years later, he returned to Nova Scotia, where he picked up work. So I came back, of course, in 1931. I was born in 1929. Came back in 31 along with the family, initially to Granville Ferry, and then to Parkville, Nova Scotia. And it was from there that I went to Mount A. And
Where'd you meet Sally Ann?
I met her in Parisbro. Parkville is only 10 miles from Parisbro.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, I met her there. Her family was living there at the time. And her father had been in the Army during the war, and he was working in Halifax. But the family had been living in Parisbro while he was overseas.
So you've lived here in East Riverside, Kinghurst, formerly, as since 1960.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen many of the houses built. Bert, of course, had built next door, just on, as I look out the window now on the left, was the Gandy House. Bill Gandy built that.
I remember Bill, yes.
About 4 families since Bill moved from there. Bill and Ermine moved from there into her mother's home in the city, right next door to St. John High School. And Bill died shortly after that. The house right below us, Morrell, built a chap named of Ed Morrell. He was the manager of Kimberly Clark. And then the house, and of course that's the one Ellie lives in now. And the house immediately below that, Adam Bardock built that, and that's the Murphy House. And those are built, well, Morrell built his the year before we built ours, 1962. And Adam Bardock built his, I think it was the following year after we built ours.
As a senior educator of the whole area, you've seen amazing changes in the school. What was there in grade school and high school here in this area then, what is now Rossay, when you were, well, back in 1960?
Well, of course, there's the public school system, which was, of course, in operation for many, many years before that, and it was a very good school system. And then RCS, of course.
And high schools?
Yes.
Or did they go into town?
No, they had high school here.
What was that? Rossay? Was that?
That's where the elementary school is, right at Rossay Corner, right now. That was the old high school.
That was the old high school?
Yes, yes. And one of the main teachers there.
Yeah. Late Doug Patterson.
Yeah.
So that was Rossay High School.
That was Rossay High School for years.
Which eventually became, what, no, KV High School?
No, KV High School was built up in Quispam Sis area, and the high school moved up into that building. The old high school became an elementary school.
The original, the elementary school, which it is now,
yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. I have to backtrack just a wee bit because across from the Harry Miller House, you know where Harry Miller, the former chief of police,
yes,
across from that, there was a school built in there, which is now a high school. And that was an intermediate school for a number of years.
So you had grade school, did you have kindergarten then?
Oh, yes, I think.
And
our youngsters went to kindergarten here.
Out here?
Yes.
Did your family all go to school out here?
Well,
or would some people go
our
to high
daughter
school?
Started in Sault Ste. Marie in kindergarten.
How many children are there? Excuse me, I didn't ask.
Two
children, yes.
Two. And Wendy, the eldest, the elder of the two, she started school in Sault Ste. Marie. And then our son, we call him J.D., John, he started school here. So he went to the local elementary school and went through the school system until he...
And went to high school here too?
No, he went to St. John High. Both of the children went to St. John High because I taught there.
Right.
So it was, in a sense, it was natural for them to go in there. And then I continued teaching there until I retired in 87. However, I became connected with UMB in 64. And I taught at both St. John High and UMB from 64 on.
You could do a book on UMB. Perhaps you'd tell us a wee bit about UMB.
Well, UMB started in 64 under heavy pressure from some local people, primarily Travis Cushing and Dr. Baird was involved in that, Ernie Whitebone, and then there are others who were very involved in putting pressure on the province and the UMB to start a branch down here. They selected the principal of Simons Regional High School and superintendent of the East St. John's school system to be their first principal, and that was Forbes Elliott.
A very good friend.
Very good friend. Also, the person for that position at that time. He had contacts. He knew who to tap if he needed assistance. And he did frequently tap people on the shoulder and said, listen, we need a little bit of money here and a little bit of money there and so on. I think C.N. Wilson, I think that, I don't know about Milt Downey, but Lawson Motors.
Lawson Motors, yes.
Yes, I think they were tapped somewhat and they assisted. And he had to acquire buildings, you know, and hold classes and hold labs and for a library and so on. And he was able to have, you know, with his knowledge of the city, know who owned these buildings and who to rent them from.
So UNB was just as far as the branch goes, it was just a dream at that stage with Forbes.
It was somewhat of a dream and somewhat of a hodgepodge initially. The way it happened, as far as staff goes, is that UMB came down to St. John to meet with representatives of the school board and representatives of St. John High. The reason why St. John High was involved is because we had grade 13, one of the few schools
senior
left
matriculation.
One of the few schools left in the province of grade 13. And it was supposedly on the same level as first-year university.
I took grade 12, yes.
Yeah, and they didn't want the two in the city at the same time competing, particularly when grade 13 had no tuition and the first-year university would have tuition, so which one would draw more students? So anyway, the appeal was made for St. John High to give up their grade 13. And we met over in a restaurant over in Main Street, and I happened to be there along with Dr. Harrison, the principal of the school, representing the St. John High School. And we were asked to give up grade 13. And I clearly remember Harrison saying, I think I'm in a meeting where I'm going to say my last swan song, and this will be the last of grade 13. Of course, he retired shortly after that. But anyway, it came about faculty. Where could they get faculty? Well, they knew where they'd get some. And Dr. Argue, who was Dean of Science at UMB, said, well, I can handle the biology. I can come down twice a week and spend 3 hours each trip down here and teach the biology, and I'll do that for 1 year. Then you have to get somebody to fill the position. And Professor Alan Boone, head of the physics department, said, I'll do the same thing in physics. I'll come down twice a week. And they turned to Francis Toole, who was an elderly chap at this time, head of the chemistry department, somewhat of a vocal lad. He said, there's no way I'm going to come down at all. He said, we have somebody here in the city who can do the job. The only trouble is he's tied up at St. John High School. I had worked with Francis Toole, Dr. Toole, before. He said, what we have to do for chemistry is to get the school board to release him to teach the course, first year chemistry. And they wrote to, and I've seen the copy of the letter where Forbes wrote to Dr. McKenzie requesting my services. And McKenzie replying said, yes, we'd be delighted to have him do it.
That was what year?
That was 1964.
1964?
That was the summer of 64. And we were supposed to start classes about 3 weeks after that.
You're talking chemistry and physics, biology, was it science faculty?
That was the science group. Now, the others had been established pretty well. They had to import those.
Do you remember, yes, you would, of course, what other faculties were there?
Well, there was English, mathematics, French.
Under the arts degree?
It was a first year towards any degree, in a sense, because they had to go to Fredericton after that.
So this was first year...
64. Yeah, first year only.
First year only in 64, okay.
Yeah. And they were able to get, for French, Dr. Joe Doherty, who taught at St. Malachy's, to do something similar to what I did. And but Joe taught only for a couple years like that. But I stayed on teaching.
Until retirement?
Pretty well. I missed 1 year.
So you finished high school in 1962, 63?
In 87, I retired from the St. John High School staff, but kept on with UMB, except I had a year gap in there.
Well, did you do both high school and UMB?
Yes.
Both at
yes.
the same time?
Yes. Yeah. And I was in the chem department. We had about 27 chemistry classes, about 7 or 8 chemistry teachers, head of the physics department.
Well, that's why you know all the students in town.
Well, at one time, I knew all the chemistry teachers in the province.
Everybody knows Dr. Wagstaff.
Yeah.
Sticking with UNB's history, when did it evolve from a first year into faculties?
The second year, they put in the second year courses, and they kept like that only 2 years for a while. Sally Ann is a rather unique person in the history of UMBSJ. Sally Ann decided that she would like to take some courses. And of course, by this time, 69 had come around, and the new buildings had been built out on the present campus and opened in the fall of 69. Prior to that, we had classes in the what we call the barn in behind the Beaverbrook House. We had classes in the Y. We had classes down the old provincial building in the corner of Canterbury and Princess Street.
Okay.
We had them all over. Labs, for a year or so, we had them at St. John High. Then we went out to the new technical school out in Grandview Avenue, and we had classes, labs out there. But there were a variety of people involved in the labs. I remember the first year in chemistry for the labs, we had them at St. John High. There were so many students, we had to split it in two. And Dr. Gerhard Fink came down weekly from Fredericton to supervise one of the labs, and I supervised the other one. But we kept bringing a variety of people in, you know, to help. But getting back to Sally Ann, the unique thing about her is she decided that she would like to take some courses because our youngsters were getting along now. So she would have to go down the foot of the hill, catch a drive there. There were a bus system. We had a bus system at that time. She would catch a bus into the city, change buses there by the Bank of Montreal at the King's Quay, take the bus out to the university, attend her class, and then reverse the process coming in. And I thought, this is a real nuisance in a way. So two doors away on her right, John Spears was living there. And John was the owner and of the Port City Motors, which was a Chrysler dealer. And I loaned Sally Ann the car one day, and I walked down the foot of the hill to catch the bus to go in to St. John High School. And John came down the hill and picked me up and he offered to drive me in to the high school. And I said, John, you don't have an old car, do you, around, something that's cheap, you know? I was thinking of letting Sally Ann have my car, which is a Dodge at the time. And anyway, he said, listen, I just had one passed in on a trade. He said, it's not in particularly good shape. You can't drive it too fast because it has a little bit of a knock in the motor. But I'll give it to you for $200. So anyway, I bought this old Chev car, and I let Sally Ann have the other one. Well, she was furious with me for going into debt, you know, $200 at this time. Anyway, 2 days later, she came and she gave me a kiss. She said, thank you, thank you, thank you.
What would teachers have been earning in those days, early 60s?
Well,
you remember?
I remember clearly. I started teaching at Mount Allison Academy in 1949. Mount Allison Academy. They had an academy.
49.
In 49.
Having graduated from high school where?
Well, I graduated from high school in Port Coverville, and then went to Mount A in 45.
Right.
But in 49, I began teaching there, and I taught for $1,200 a year plus a room and meals. And I finally moved up, I think it was to about $1,400 a year. Taught there for 3 years. And then I knew the academy was going to close. It was very obvious when the talk was going on. So any result, I thought I better go out and get a job out in the public school system. And I landed a job over in Annapolis Valley, the Cambridge Rural High School. And just this past summer, it had its 50th anniversary. So anyway, landed a job over there, and I was making $1,900 and some over there. And that was a big raise, you know, from 2000, except I had to pay board, at least over there. So altogether, I probably wasn't earning much more. Stayed there only for 1 year. I happened to be at the academy during the summer, and there was a conference going on, a Red Cross conference, and Forbes Elliott was there. And I had heard of Forbes Elliott before. I never met him, but I had a chance to meet him. And I said, Forbes, Mr. Elliott, I noticed that an ad in this morning's paper for a chemistry teacher at St. John High School. He said, oh, that's not right. He said, Don Middlemas is teaching chemistry there, and Don's still there. And anyway, he said, it must be a vocational school. He had just taken over as principal of the Simon, so he knew it wasn't there. So it has to be vocational, because those are the only three schools, and other than St. Vincent's at the time. And he said, I'm sure it's not St. Vincent's, and it has to be vocational. So anyway, he must have been inquiring about me, because the next morning I received a phone call from Dr. McKenzie, offering me the job teaching chemistry at St. John High School.
At St. John High School?
Yeah. I had never approached them at all. Forbes looked at the paper, saw it was St. John, found that Don Middlemas had resigned and gone to take the superintendency at St. Stephen. And that left a vacancy, which was unexpected in a way. So he phoned McKenzie and said, I know where you can get a teacher right now.
So he was
available. Forbes is the one.
So he was a friend and a mentor for you.
Yes, and then he was the first principal of UMBSJ when it started, of course, and he was the one who wrote the letter to McKenzie asking for my services there. So Forbes has been very, very, very involved in my history.
He was a special friend of many, many people, including myself.
Yeah.
From the mid-60s, how has UNB evolved, and what do you see its future?
UNB, of course, once it moved out to the campus, expanded quite a lot. However, there was a relatively small faculty, and we had social events monthly. We also had one dining room, and most people ate in that dining room.
Where was it?
It was in the lower floor of where the library is now.
Okay.
At UMB. So as a result, we knew everybody. We knew the whole faculty. I knew them all, you know, even though I was only a part-time staff teacher there. Then it became departmentalized into arts, science, and others. physical education, things of that sort. Business came in gradually. And after it was separated, then we got to know everybody in our own unit. But there wasn't the cross-fertilization sense right across the campus. So I don't know most of the people over in the arts section now. I don't know the phys ed people, except the occasional one. The only people I know in arts, you know, are ones that I meet in the dining room. If they don't come to the dining room, I don't see them at all. And I don't know the names of them at all. I just don't know them. But anyway, it's progressed. In the field of chemistry, when they first started down in the old provincial building, this is before 69, they hired Dr. Ron Kelly, who had been working down in Kalamazoo, down in the United States, in a drug firm, as a research chemist. They hired him. Now, he had been the first PhD graduate from UMB Fredericton in chemistry. And he, of course, coming here, wanted to continue on with research. So, at that time, a young lad came over from England with a new wife, who originally was from Sackville, New Brunswick. His name was Barry Beckett. And Barry wanted to proceed to take a doctoral program in chemistry. Well, here was Ron arriving just the time Barry did. So Barry started on a PhD program under Ron. And Barry was the first graduate PhD on the campus. And he did most of his research back in the old provincial building, even before the main present campus was built. So there was one area where higher education was coming in. I remember Ron taught a number of the courses for Barry when there was only one or two in the class, Barry and myself. Is that I took the classes along with Barry, although I wasn't going for a doctor's degree at all at that time. But
this would be postgraduate work for you, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Oh, yes. And I took further postgraduate work at in Fredericton because I was hired for 6 summers to run a program called Chem Study Institute, where we brought chemistry teachers in, not just from the province of New Brunswick, to upgrade them in their chemical background, but also we brought them in from the province of Quebec. The province, they didn't have a program of this sort at all. And we ran that program with about 40 students for 6 summers. So while I was up there, I took graduate courses up there, too. And then, of course, after that, I went to Cornell, went to McMaster, and went to the University of Calgary and took further courses.
When did you get your doctorate?
In 88.
In 88?
Yeah.
Where do you see, what do you see as the future of UNB in St. John?
If they had the financing, they could expand tremendously in a variety of areas. The one that I am most familiar with, of course, in the chemistry department. And what they would like to do, and they have it on the books right now, it's a matter of just finding financing, getting it through the Senate and get it through all the various committees, Maritime Higher Education Commission, that is to start a medicinal chemistry program and also another one called forensic chemistry. Because there's no school across Canada that gives a degree in forensic chemistry, forensic science. None. The same thing true with medicinal chemistry, is that these are new fields, and they have the program outlined already, but they just don't have the financing. And I think it may hit a snag when it gets to the Higher Education Committee. If it doesn't meet the snag at the Senate level, where it is right now, it's gone that far.
Do you think it's designed to be a separate entity from Fredericton eventually?
No. I know there's pressure being put on by a group who have very little contact with the university. Politicians, there's one lawyer in particular who'd like to see it done. But no, the faculty, I don't think, is for it.
What's the small p politics of having our own university here? Why do they want it?
They want independence from the administration of Fredericton. But there are advantages being connected with Fredericton. Thing is that you don't have to duplicate your various committees. You don't have to duplicate your, for instance, your graduate studies, the administration and the things. There are a variety of things that with grants is that if you separate, then one of them's going to get, not both of them aren't going to get it. With your combine, then it comes to the one university and there is a split to some extent.
God willing, 20 years from now, if you and I are still talking together, do you feel UNBSJ will be still attached to Fredericton?
I suspect it might still be. Yeah. I don't see that the population is going to get much bigger than it is now because the demographics of New Brunswick limit it to what we can obtain in student population from the province. So that means we're dependent upon offshore people, you know, like China, now the Beijing University. We're getting a number from Middle East, and residence, of course, restricts you. We are building a new residence right now. However, there's a limit to how many you can take in before you begin swamping it with non-New Brunswick students. So I think there's a limit to the number of students which you can get right there. And I don't see the population of New Brunswick expanding for the next 20 to 30 years much over what it is right now.
What would the university population be in the mid-60s? Would there have been 1,000 students there?
It started with somewhere around 400 students, I think it was. That was in 1964. And gradually it went up. Right now, I haven't seen the figures for this year, but I'm anticipating it's around 2,700 right now.
2,700?
I think it's probably in that range right now. So I don't see where it's going to expand significantly over that, and I just don't see the province allowing another university to come into being. What they've done is they have allowed a few universities. For instance, the Baptist School is now a university in Moncton, and I've been in that building a couple times. It's a lovely little building. It's a single unit building. They have something going, I think, in St. Andrews or St. Stephen, I forget which one it is.
What's that, community college?
No, they have a community college in St. Andrews. This is another religious one. But, you know, you have St. Thomas, you have UMB.
Is that an affiliation, St. Thomas?
In a quasi way, is they do have a crossing with classes, but they are separate administrations. They do offer separate degrees. They do offer separate programs. But some of the students from St. Thomas come down to take UMB courses, and the vice versa takes place, I think, to some extent.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are some of the fondest memories of this now Rossay area? Have you had a happy 40-some years growing up here?
Yeah, it's been a wonderful area. I always think of our daughter-in-law when she first came here. She said, what a great place. She said, she had been living in Halifax. And she said, you have lots of decent sizes. We don't have that in Halifax at all. As it, houses are jammed up and things. So you do have that. Very quiet. There is not a great deal of traffic and things like that. Not a great deal of crime. We don't have, in this immediate area, we don't have commercialism at all. You know, that's in Quispam Sis, primarily, but in Rossay and East Riverside, we don't have commercialism. It was a great place for youngsters to grow up.
For that reason?
Yes, a great spot.
What churches were here then as you grew up in your 40 years ago?
Well, beginning from Rossay, of course, there's the little Anglican church. But then we had to come to Rossay itself, and there was St. David's. And, of course, when we moved to St. John, we joined Portland United Church in the city, went to Sault Ste. Marie, attended the United Church up there, returned here, went back to Portland. But it was no fun driving into Portland on Sunday morning from Rossay. The road was rough.
Was it paved then?
It was paved, but it was pretty bad shape.
Yep.
A two-lane highway only at that time out in Rossay Avenue. So as a result, we decided that we would try St. David's, and we did, and we were quite pleased with the people who were there, the minister.
When did you go to remember St. David's? That's a special church. When did you first go there?
1962.
You remember the minister then?
Yes.
Would it have been Reverend Titus?
No, before.
Ray.
Reverend Ray.
Lori Ray. Lori Ray, an Englishman, originally.
How long, who was next?
I think Bill Titus was next, after that. And then Ted McLeod. And in between, we had two or three, you know, to fill in.
Yep.
The one I particularly remember was Dr. Neal, the old gentleman who had done most of his ministry in Maine, and who could go in the pulpit without a single note and just give a sermon, a wonderful sermon and everything.
Great memories from him. After Reverend Ted, then, would have been Reverend McLean?
Yes, yes. And then after McLean, then came...
Then there was an interim minister then, wasn't there?
Yes. We've had an interim minister between each one. It's good to have an interim break, I think, between.
Following then Reverend McLean, then it was Reverend Bob Stevens, was it?
Yes. Yes, it was. And that was an experience in itself.
He retired, some years ago, did he?
Yes, he was here either 9 or 10 years, surprisingly.
And who's the minister now at St. David's?
Well, of course, we have Ron Vincent.
Reverend Ron Vincent.
Yeah, right now. Yeah. But so we've gone through a number of ministers, but each one has stayed a fairly length of time. You know.
Is that a growing congregation?
There are new members coming in. Many of them we don't know. We see them, you know, in church. We don't know them, young families. But there are a number of the older families who are leaving. There are some not attending for separate reason, which is not part of this conversation at all. But anyway, it's a vibrant. It has always been a vibrant church.
Is this area growing? Are there a lot of young people moving into what is now Rossay?
Rossay, yes. As we drive around, the number of new homes just astounds us in Rossay and in Quispamsis in particular. More so probably in Quispamsis because there's not that much growth here. The other day I happened to be driving along the main highway, the Mackay Highway, and started down the Fox Farm Road. And I thought, I wonder if they've built along the hill further. So, there's a part of the old East Riverside which was attached to Renforth, you know.
Yes.
Down the other, in towards the city. So I drove up in that area to see if they extended the housing, and they haven't, surprisingly. But they have extended a little bit from this way. There is a whole lot of land in there, in between East Riverside and Renforth. That could be open for development. But it's pretty well
filled. Do you see the new Rossay now, which is more part of it? Do you see it growing in the years ahead?
There is land where it can grow, and of course I think it's going to remain a residential community. I don't see any commercialism at all. I don't think that we'll have a town council or a population who wants commercialism in this area, in Rossay itself. So there are some sites where you can have further development, and you might have another 200 or 300 more homes, and that's about the land we have. Except, right across the street, which used to be a farm, where they had a herd of Jersey cattle when we came here for some years, it was a Mackay farm, now owned in the Olin. The old interest somehow. But anyway, that is a huge bit of property there. It extends from here.
Who's up, that owned by now?
That's owned by one of the Olins. I think one of Phil Olin's son has control of it.
Perhaps Mr. Dick Olin, would it be?
It could be. I'm not sure which one of the boys.
Right.
It's one of the boys. But that is a tremendous property right there. And if that were ever opened up, there's a spot for I don't know how many homes. Fabulous. No. I remember sitting at Sully Inn. I sat with Phil and Mary Olin one time at a banquet, and Mary said, as long as I own that property, it'll never be subdivided, never be changed. It'll be available just as it is now and available for the horse club, which does use it still.
Right.
Yeah.
What has been your interest in how have you participated in the Kennebecasis River? Is it something that's you've seen the usage change over the years in the past 40-some years?
Well,
did you use it as a much younger man?
I didn't use it personally. Our two youngsters did in some way because they took sailing classes for two or three summers.
Where did they take their sailing classes?
Out of Renforth, Rossay Yacht Club.
Rossay Yacht Club?
Yeah. And
that club was active then, was it?
Very active. Very active then. One of the leading people behind that, besides Bruce Tennant, was Arthur Lee White. And anyway, they encouraged me to join. However, we had a cottage in Nova Scotia.
And we're down Parsborough there, area?
In Parsborough area. We're down there.
Which you still have.
Yeah, you still have, yeah. So our youngsters, Sally Ann will be here. And also, I was teaching in Fredericton. I had the Chemistry Study Institute, and then I was tied up with the Navy. I was in the Reserve Navy, and I was going away every summer when I wasn't at UMB, working the summer in the Navy, in Cornwallis, Stadacona, out at sea, and things of that sort.
Have you ever seen any commercial activity on the Kennebecasis River, or did you hear about it as a younger man? I understand there was a shipyard.
Yes.
In East Riverside.
Right at the foot of Allaby Drive. There's a shipyard there, and you can see where the rocks are still going out, and it was right in that area, as I understand.
Was there talk about it, or did you know people who worked there? Or?
No. I think it was back in the 1800s, probably in the real heyday of the square-rigged ships. You know, I'm talking about 1850, 1860, 1870s.
I understand Judge Glennie's wife has done a book with some information about that shipyard.
Yes, no doubt.
And, so your children used the river for sailing and swimming?
Yes. And then, of course, we have two yacht clubs, in a sense. We have the Renforth. And, of course, besides sailing, the normal sailing, you have the rowing, which is taking place, you know, out of the Renforth yacht
club. Was that big in your day as
yes,
well?
Yes, it was. Yes.
Yeah. You mentioned Bruce Tennant. The Rossay Living Museum had a special evening recognizing Bruce Tennant because the students of Rossay High School have done paintings from Bruce Tennant's amazing collection of photographs.
Oh, I didn't know you had one.
About capturing the history of the Rossay Yacht Club.
Yeah.
So.
Wonderful. Well, in the my first recollection of the rowing, we became friendly with a chap by the name of Parker. That was his last name. And he was a rower, and a thing happened to him, much the same as happened to Renforth after when the community is named, is that Parker was rowing out one day, and then he was coming in, and he took a heart attack and died in the boat, very similar to what Renforth did.
Parker, Mr. Parker.
Yeah, no, he lived up about the third or fourth house going up Country Club Heights.
And he was just out doing competitive racing or rowing?
Competitive rowing, yeah. His widow remarried, and she married a chap, and they built a house. I think it's the second house from the lighthouse on the loop, you know, down the
Renforth loop.
Yeah, she was a Saunders originally. Ermine Saunders was her name.
Okay.
And she's probably approaching 75 right now, and she lived there. but it was her first husband, and she had one or two children, I think.
Okay.
And that as well.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the bus system.
Yeah.
There was a bus system?
Yes.
In your younger days?
Yes. Yes.
Who ran it and where did it go?
I have no idea who ran it, but it went in the city. Casale Inn took it in the city. And
so a city bus system? I think it was a private system.
I think it was private.
Where'd they go to? Rossay, New Rossay or Hampton or?
No, I really don't know how far out it went. I don't know if it went to Gondola Point or if it went up towards Kispamsis. I have no idea where it originated. Thing is that whenever we used it, we just walked down the foot of the hill and pick it up there and come home by it.
How long did that last, you remember?
I really can't tell you, Bill. I don't know.
Trains. Well, we're on transportation. You hear people talk about the train system, and you hear about the old train station. Was there a train, active train system in your day?
Yes. Yes. And, of course, there was only one station. That was at Rossay. Prior to that, however, there was a station, and they used to sort mail, I think, and they had a little post office right at the foot of Country Club Heights, right there. And then there was another stop at in Renforth.
Who used this train?
All the people in the city, because they would come out, you know, the summertime. This was a summer community for many of the people, and a lot of the houses out here in Rossay, East Riverside, on the main road. A lot of those houses were nothing but cottages originally, then converted, you know, and additions put on and converted into all your homes. But
do you, in your day, remember the train stations, or was it prior to your time?
No, these stations were gone at the foot of Country Club Heights when we came here.
Was there any stations left here?
Only the Rossay one.
It existed then?
Oh, yes.
Is that where the photography set the station house?
Yes.
Which has gone through many hands in the past 4, 5, 6 years?
Yeah.
Including Martin Flewelling and Bill Hart.
Yes. The other thing which we had, of course, we had the Acadia bus line which came through here regularly.
Going to Moncton and...
Going to Moncton. It used this as a route through here. The main incident that I recall, my first car, which we bought when we came to Sault Ste. Marie, was a little English Anglia. Just a little thing. And we went to Nova Scotia for Christmas one year. Our two children were with us. And on the way back from Parsborough, we started running into a snowstorm at a place called Napan. And we get into Amherst, and it was snowing heavier there. And, of course, you're right along a flat, so it was sifting across the road. And I took and drove the car into the bus station in Amherst, and I said, Sully Ann, I'm going to put you on the bus with the two children, and I'll drive home and see if I can get home on the storm. But you'll probably get home all right in the bus. So anyway, left them, and I had my little Anglia hard to the floor, going across Tantramar Flat. I was going between 30 and 40 miles an hour. I got into Moncton, waited for them. I was ahead of them. The bus arrived, and I said, all right, now I'll head down. And it started to get colder, and the heating system was worthless almost. I had a little spot like that that I could look out, and I was looking out through this hole, in a sense. I finally get into Renforth. We're living in the house in Renforth next to Nesbitt's. And the bus hadn't arrived. I was ahead of them. They're traveling even at 30 or 40 because they had to stop in Sussex and, you know, in all the little places. Petticoatiac, and they had to stop there for 5 or 10 minutes. And Salisbury, you know, everywhere along the way. Anyway, I beat them home and got the heat on, And lo and behold, the bus came along after a while, and I got them off the bus and got them in the house. So,
what was local government like in the mid-60s? Did we have a council in the mid-60s?
Yes, but I can't tell you when the council started. I think Bert Cosman was one of the councillors, one of the early councillors, and he was mayor before John Britton took over.
Right.
I don't know just how many years he was mayor, but...
What was before that? Would it be local service district?
That I don't know. I don't know.
Have you noticed much change in governments, provincial or local, in the past 40 years?
Well, of course, one of the big changes took place in equal opportunity when Leo Robichaud's government was in. Is that I think it was then that the province began collecting taxes. It used to be our taxes would only go to the local municipal government, in a sense, but then the government began collecting
taxes. Was equal opportunity a good thing?
Yes, it was. I think if you have to look at the big picture. Certainly, St. John was opposed to it, because the thing is that some of the northern parts of the province certainly weren't getting their fair share of the provincial dollar. And there was an equalization, in a sense, that way. And I remember the school system, we lost some of our financing. Because one of the things which was unique for the city of St. John, the school board in St. John was a separate, limited company. It was an autonomous unto itself. Is that they set their own budget, turned it over to the city, and the city had to raise the money for it, and could not take and veto a single thing that was in the budget at all. Had no control over it. It was simply the school board. And the other unique thing is, as far as the educational system, is we went into a provincial pension system for the teachers.
Teachers, right?
Yeah. Prior to that, we didn't have a provincial pension system. It was administered locally to some extent. And
that'd be a positive for the teachers?
Oh, yes, it was, very much. Well,
while we're on politics, the word amalgamation comes up occasionally. What's that all about, and are you in favor of it?
Well, I certainly was not in favor of amalgamation with the city of St. John.
What was the amalgamation talk a few years ago? What did they want to do?
Well, the talk was, before the report came out on amalgamation, was that there's a possibility of this whole area being amalgamated into one unit.
Whole area meaning what?
Well, that would be Renforth, East Riverside, Rossay, Gondola Point.
Fairvale.
Yeah, Fairvale was thought possibly. And then up in the west side of the river, some of those communities be all.
What was that, like Westfield and
Westfield,
Grand Bay?
Yeah. Something similar to what they did in Halifax. In Halifax, they amalgamated Dartmouth, Bedford, and down along both shores, both east and west.
Was that amalgamation idea popular here for Rossay?
Not complete amalgamation. I think there was tremendous opposition for a complete amalgamation.
So what happened here? Rossay became...
Rossay took in Renforth, the old Rossay, East Riverside.
I guess Fairvale.
Fairvale and
Wells.
Wells,
I guess.
That's
for
right.
For the five.
Yeah. And then Quispam took in Gondola Point, and they may have taken in another...
Was that a popular alternative, do you think?
It may not have been popular, but I think it's working out all right.
Do you see further amalgamation?
No, I don't. I don't see for some time. It may come about eventually, but I certainly...
What would the first step be?
I think the first step, if there's a further amalgamation, would probably be Quispam, Sis, and Rossay.
What do you think of that idea?
That may work out all right, because we are cooperating to a great extent now. Police force, fire department, sewage, treatment. There's a lot of common things which we're working together with.
Are you happy the way Rossay is working now?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
What changes would you like to see for Rossay, if any?
I I'm at a dead loss.
Which is indicative of a lot of satisfaction.
Yes, yeah. Because I think Rossay is going to be a strict, you know, I'm talking about the Rossay as we know it right now. It's going to be a strict residential community.
Is Quispam developing into more of a commercial, do you think?
Yes, yeah. The one thing which is still lacking to some extent in Quispam says are facilities for youngsters. You know, we do have the rink in Rossay. We do have the rink in Quispam Sis. We do have some ball fields, things like that. But the police department have been involved, I think, in developing a program in the Quispam Sis arena for the summer. But there are a lot of people don't play baseball. There are a lot of people don't play hockey. And in the summer in particular, you know, hockey is not going on at the time. So what you have are fields for those. We don't have much in swimming. We have a tennis court.
Swimming would either be in the river or in the...
Yes, but the problem with the river, the problem with the river is that I don't think there's that much swimming like it used to be, because at one time we had a certain amount of pollution in the river, and infection, of course, takes place to some extent. But tennis courts and things of that sort, we don't have a great number of those at all. I think there's an opportunity to develop some of those for our youth.
Tennis?
Yes.
And what else?
Well, squash courts. One of the things, of course, is very popular in all communities now is skateboarding and things of that sort for youngsters.
Right.
Yeah, and they're, you know, rather than having on streets, which they're doing to some extent, if we could have a central spot for them. But I think we have an increase in the youth, and as a result, we have to look after them.
As an educator, you've seen the system evolve progressively and positively. You mentioned Rossay Collegiate. What changes have you seen there over the years?
In the last few years, phenomenal changes. There's been an influx.
Is that a private school?
That's a private school, I think. It was affiliated with the with the Anglican Church originally, I believe. I think it's probably lost its that strong affiliation with the Anglican Church, but it's primarily a private school. And of course, it has grown out of two schools, Netherwood and Rossay Collegiate. And first there was amalgamation of classes, and then after that they amalgamated them completely administratively and housing and things of that sort. They sold the old Netherwood residence and sold the property. So everything is up on the one campus now. It's a beautiful campus.
I see some new buildings there. Mr. Irving has been very supportive, I believe.
I would say so, because the money, big money, has come in, because they have a new rink, they have a new gym, there are new houses for faculty members, which are well up back. I don't know if you've seen some of those up there.
No.
No.
There's squash courts there now, too. Is that connected with RCS?
Yeah. Yes, and last year, Sally Ann and I went up and watched the national soccer tournament between private schools right across Canada.
Is that right?
And they have wonderful facilities. They have about four or five fields for soccer, and three or four of these were in operation simultaneously. And it was a great spot. Of course, they were housed in the city, because we don't have housing out here.
Right.
That's one thing which we don't have in the community, is a reasonable hotel.
Should there be a hotel here?
I think eventually we're going to have a hotel.
Well, we're on RCS Netherwood. Do you see a growth in private schooling systems such as RCS Netherwood?
There is a trend towards that. For instance, the Baptist school, which is a private religious school, is taking place. And if we find that there's discontent with a public school system, then I think we'll find more of these private schools developing.
One of the problems which I've seen in my time in the educational system is there was a change about 17 years ago of taking the design of programs and courses out of the hands of the teachers, and it was put in the hands of those in Fredericton primarily, who frequently imported programs which had been in 4 or 5 years in other districts, you know, in other jurisdictions, United States in some cases, across Western Canada in some cases, and been a full trial in those jurisdictions, and some of them essentially failed. And here, they were being introduced here. And after about 4 or 5 years, they began to fail here, too. And we've gone through a number of those programs in the last 15 years that I've been not overly familiar with, but I've been aware of them. And I retired just as there was a big change coming in, a change which came about not from the teachers, but from Fredericton and from non-educational people who expertise wasn't in the field of education particularly. Drastic changes, and I don't think it helped our educational system. Matter of fact, I think it was a deterrent to our educational system. In 1987, when I retired, is that we were making and producing some excellent students, you know, in their background and things. And then all of a sudden, there was a complete change, and about 5 years later, another complete change. And the most notable one was a foundation program, which they had in the junior high school. They had to scrap that after 2 years. It just was inoperative. The problem was the province instituted these new programs and didn't provide training and didn't provide the equipment and facilities.
Is it on track now, in your opinion?
I don't know, because I've been out of it too long.
But the only thing, or one of the things we haven't touched on today, Riverside Golf Course has been around since you were a young man.
Yeah.
Is that still a popular institution, and do you see growth there? And there's even rumors about some development there.
Yes.
What are your comments about Riverside?
Yes. I've heard about the developments and things. I've heard that the roof needs to be repaired, and the cost of it is so high that they may build a new building, things like that.
Do you think there's room in Rossay for additional condominiums? Multiple family housing?
Let's get to one thing about the golf course before we leave. Is that for years, the golf course was a closed club where those of other faiths, particularly the Jewish faith, were not welcome. And those of other minority groups were not welcome. There wasn't a single black a member. There wasn't a single Jewish chap who was a member. I think when they began to run into financial troubles back in the 1960s, they offered a Jewish chap that I knew a membership, and he declined, Dr. Silver. And he said, there's no way. He said, they turned me away one time, and now they want me to join, help them out of the financial bind. He said, there's no way I'll just join. It's the way they treated me before. I think with new membership, that attitude has changed quite a lot. So I think we've had a major change in the composition of the membership and in the whole approach of dealing with people.
And that's a big positive, I believe.
A very big positive thing. I remember one of our, Andrew Garrett was his name, who was the head of our English department at St. John High School. We used to have our annual dinner at the end of the year, and we had it booked for Riverside Golf Club, and Andrew said, I'll not go there. They don't allow Jewish people in. Now, he was not Jewish, but he said, if they have that policy, I'll not attend. Same with the Union Club in the city, is they had the same
That, of course, has changed, I believe, now.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. So anyway, that's been a major change which has taken place in the golf club. Now about condominiums.
Is there room for them in Rossay?
There is a room, I think, for senior homes of some sort. We have an aging population, and it comes to a point where some of these older people can no longer take care of their lawns and the painting, whatever is required.
Snow. You
know, snow, removal, whatever is required. And it comes to a point where they'll probably have to move into some other type of accommodations. And senior housing is one of them. And we are short on senior housing. And where do we go? Well, some of our residents, people who would like to stay here, are now over in the north end of the city of St. John.
What about Lowood?
I remember before Lowood was built, a big house there, owned by the shipping firm in the city, the largest shipping firm in Canada, I think at the time, the Troop family, and the Troop summer home was still existing when we first moved here. And then it was sold out of the family, and it was torn down, and the Lowood development was built there, and that was in our day.
Do you think there's room for more quality
Yes.
developments like Lowood?
Yes. One of the things that I've always felt, if you're building senior homes, it should be built near where you have a bank, where you have possibly a barber shop or a hair
beauty parlor,
beauty parlor, where you can get a few groceries, you know, so the seniors don't have to go too far, because if they go into a senior, it may be they've lost their driving facility, their driving privileges at that time, and they have to be able to get to these service outfits. So where could that be developed? In Rossay right now, there are some spots left where it could be developed, but they're getting mighty small now. The best one is right near the supermarket, superstore, across the street from the route, you know, which goes down beside the Tim Hortons
right
store. There's a whole area down there which could be developed, which is near.
For senior housing.
Yeah, near the bank and so on. And I have no idea if that's in the plans for anyone at all.
You'd like to see more of that?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Jack, we're talking to Dr. Jack Wagstaff, his wife Sally Ann. Any other thoughts you'd like to share? This is for posterity. This will go on the website and be recorded for posterity, our discussion today.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts you'd like to share?
One thing I recall, when we first moved out here, there was no sewage system. We had our own sewage field, everyone. We had our own wells, and many still have their own wells.
You have your own well here?
We're on a well that Bert looks after, and I think he supplies water to 12 or 13 houses. We're under contract to him until a municipal water system comes in. But we had no street lights, and we didn't have paved roads. And a meeting was held to discuss paving and street lights. It was held in the gym of what now is the Rossay High School. And that was a high school one time, Doug Patterson principal there, before the KVHS. And I remember two people in particular who were vehemently opposed to streetlights and to paving. Andrew Green and his relative, Mr. Renshaw. And they put up a strong argument against it. And finally...
Unfortunately, Mr. Green died recently.
Yes. And when it came to a vote, they were about the only two who voted against it. And when they found out the overwhelming support for streetlights and for paved roads and things, then I remember Andy standing up and he said, "Well, let's make it unanimous." He said, But
he was a great gentleman.
He was not going to give in until the very last thing, but he was going to have a say on it, yeah.
Anything else, Dr. Jai?
Yeah. No, that's it, except there are two old farmhouses in the local area. Next door was the old Green Farm, and this was part of that farm at one time. And when we first started developing this as a lot for our own lot, we found remnants of an old blacksmith shop right next door.
Okay.
Where they probably shoot horses and did things of that sort, I don't know. And we found barrows in like a little brook ran down across our lot. And we found old barrows and things like that in there, remnants. So that was part of the old farm we had.
Well, you've had a great life here.
Oh, wonderful.
Your plans to... You're allegedly retired, but you're still extremely busy in church and other activities.
Yeah, yes, I'm still 3 days a week out at the university.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Is it your plans to stay here, you and Sally Ann?
At the present time, I think Sally Ann would probably like to move back to Parsville.
Right.
But the thing is, we have a lovely home here.
And
we
have
a lovely community. People we know. We also have some wonderful friends in Parsville.
Right.
Because we're there half the year, practically.
You go down there in...
May. And Sally Ann comes home late September or October. I come home a little bit earlier because of university work. But she'd be quite content. And, of course, she has some relatives who live there.
Down there, right.
And my home was 10 miles away. Our old family home we still have in the family. Our son and daughter are part owners of the house.
Okay.
So we still are active around there. I'm very active in two historic societies down there. One, the HSAO Museum. The other one is the Parsible Shore Historic Society. I give 2 days a week, all summer long, to those, one to each one.
Right.
And we're down there other days besides that. Sally Ann does all the flowers, flower arrangement and things like that for the Parsable Shore Historic Society during the summer months. So we're very active in it.
So your time is divided by two special homes.
Yeah, we are.